Chapter 20, The Next Targets. Almost before I knew it, it was June of 1944. The Marianas Islands were the next targets on our island-hopping campaign that had begun at Guadalcanal. The official name for that Marianas campaign was Operation Forager. Our new objectives were Saipan, Tinian, Guam, and Peleliu. They were to be the next stepping stones toward our final destination, Japan itself. Operation Forager was under the command of Admiral Nimitz, and Marine General Holland Smith was in charge of the amphibious landings. Howling Mad Smith was what everyone called him. I met Major General Smith several times during the war. Though he seemed like a mild-mannered man, more like a middle-aged storekeeper than a Marine, I also saw what he looked like when he was angry. His face became red as fire, and he seemed to grow twice as tall. We were divided into two task forces. The Northern Task Force was made up of the 2nd and 4th Marine Divisions. The Southern Task Force was made up of the 3rd Marine Division and the 1st Army Brigade. I was in that 3rd Marine Division and found myself reunited with several of my former Signal Corps buddies, including Smitty and Georgia Boy, who once again tried to crack my ribs with one of his southern bear hugs. "Chief," he drawled, "I am so all-fired glad to see you." Smitty pulled back the sleeve of his shirt and held his brown arm next to mine. "Look here," he said. "While our boy Ned has been up in shady Honolulu, we've been down here in the sunny South Pacific working on our tans." Soon, the talk turned to where we were headed. Would it be Saipan or Guam? We didn't have long to wait. Our orders came down the next day. The Northern Task Force would be taking Tinian and Saipan. Our objective was Guam. All these years later, I'm still thankful that I wasn't sent to Saipan. The other code talkers who landed there all came back alive, but they still don't know how they survived. Their D-Day was June 15th, 1944. There was much resistance against our first waves that came ashore, and the sea was rough. Boats were tipping over before they even came close to the beach. Jesse Smith, Wilford Billy, Danny Aki, Frank Thompson, and Carl Gorman. They were some of the code talkers who landed on Saipan. They said that it was the worst place they had ever been. Of course, none of us had yet seen Iwo Jima. "Shells were hitting the water all around us," Jesse Smith told me later. "Some people had to cut off their packs to keep from drowning, and then struggle into shore without guns or any equipment." "But when things got a little quieter," Wilford Billy added, "those of us who lost our stuff were able to go back down to the beach and get packs and guns from the men who got killed and were washed up on shore. There was more than enough." Saipan was 14 miles long and 5 miles wide. Before war came to it, it must have been a beautiful place with its palm trees and sugar plantations. It was the first island the U.S. Marines invaded where there was still a population of Japanese civilians, including many women and children. Having those women and children to defend probably made the Japanese soldiers resist even harder. They fought on the beaches and from caves where their soldiers were dug in. Just as had been the case so many times before, our naval bombardment and air assaults hadn't been very effective in knocking out the coastal defenses. Hundreds of Marines died in the water and on the beaches. As our Marines moved farther inland, the Japanese kept sending wave after wave of bonsai attacks against them. But Howling Mad Smith refused to order his Marines to retreat. This is one of the messages that Wilfred Billy sent for General Smith. To all units, be on alert for bonsai attacks. Dig in and report positions. The enemy screamed and threw hand grenades and emptied their weapons as they ran forward. There were thousands of Japanese, soldiers and civilians both, in those attacks. Some were armed with nothing more than sharpened sticks. They believed their only choice was to die for their empire. It's hard to describe how loud and frightening and terrible such attacks are. But all those bonsai attacks failed. From dug-in positions, the Marines stopped them with machine gun fire. The enemies fell like tall grass cut by a scythe. The saddest part of Saipan, Wilfred told me, was those Japanese civilians. The Japanese women and children ran from the Marines in terror. They'd been told that Americans were devils who would kill and torture them. The Japanese government propaganda frightened those poor people so much that they didn't allow themselves to be captured. They blew themselves up with grenades. They climbed to the tops of cliffs and threw their children off before hurling themselves onto the rocks below. Hundreds jumped from the cliffs near Marpy Point or waded into the ocean and drowned before our shocked Marines could reach them. There were tears in Wilfred's eyes as he remembered it. On Saipan, over 3,000 Americans died between June 15th and July 13th, when the Marines were pulled back. The entire Japanese garrison on Saipan of 20,000 men was wiped out. No one knows how many civilians took their own lives. There was no way, Wilfred said, to celebrate after that victory. Rough as it was, there were still some things we Navajos found to smile about. Danny Akee always seemed to have a funny story to tell, even about D-Day on Saipan. He and Sam Holliday, another of us code talkers, had just finished digging in. Shrapnel was raining down all around them. The ground was shaking from the explosions, and they were ducking down. All of a sudden, something heavy went splat right on Danny's helmet. "I've been hit, I've been hit," Danny yelled. Then he noticed Sam was looking at his helmet and laughing. What Danny thought was shrapnel was actually a big frog that had jumped into their hole and landed on his helmet. Then there were the chickens. During the landing, Danny had noticed them flying around. "That was one of the ways I found out how life is different for an Indian and a white man," Danny said. "Those chickens. You know those sea rations? They weren't very good. We might go 2 or 3 weeks without a hot meal. But after a while, we see those chickens that belong to the natives on that island there. So I say to Samuel, 'You make a slingshot.' Samuel, he was a good shot, and he killed one right away. Those white men, they didn't know how to make a chicken stew, but we found a big can and boiled water and cut up that chicken and put it in. Of course, everybody is watching us. 'What are you doing, Chief?' they ask us. 'Well, we're going to make chicken stew.' And we did, you know. We cook it, and everyone wants a taste of warm soup there. Even the colonel, he said, 'Grab me one, Samuel.' Everybody was boiling chicken soup right around there all day."